This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Statistically, in America, if you're born into a household living beneath the federal poverty line, even if you never smoke cigarettes and never become obese, you still have a life expectancy about 7 years shorter than that of people not born into poverty. And if you're uninsured, your life expectancy is still shorter. This hour, as part of our series, North Carolina Voices, Understanding Poverty, we consider why. Why do people living in poverty often have shorter, less healthy lives? And we'll also consider how the medical system and how health insurance policy affects those numbers. For some working people, even some with health insurance, a medical crisis can be the difference between making ends meet and falling into debt and possibly poverty. Does this situation sound familiar to you? Is the solution to the health care crisis universal coverage? Or do we need to cut out medical excess? Or train more doctors? We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862, 1-877-962-9862. With us today are Dr. Norton Hadler, who is a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and author of the book, The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Hadler.
Thank you, Melinda.
And with us on the line from Duke University is Chris Conover, who is a professor of public policy studies in the Center for Health Policy at Duke. Welcome, Chris Conover.
It's a pleasure to be here today, Melinda.
Well, let us start with the numbers, if we could, Dr. Hadler. People living in poverty have a shorter life expectancy, high risk for diseases like blood pressure and diabetes. Why is that? Is it environmental? Is it their living conditions?
We need some new definitions for our discussion today. We've been talking all week about poverty as if it was a discrete border between those who are in poverty and those who are not, but clearly it isn't. Now, defining it as a discrete event is useful. It's useful for the policy workers. The definition usually depends on some multiple of what the amount of money you need to survive. But for the perspective of health and disease, we need to think of a continuum that that pertains to all resource-advantaged countries. It turns out that the lower your socioeconomic status, the sooner you die. And that's all-cause mortality. That's not just everything we're hearing about as discrete entities, but the sooner you die. And if we're going to talk about the relationship between socioeconomic status and health, we have to define health as something more than just longevity. Health is very hard to define. Disease is easier. Disease defines itself. Health has something to do with longevity, something to do with the quality of the trip. And what we've learned at the first cut is the lower your socioeconomic status in the resource-advantaged world, the sooner you die, and the lower the quality of the trip. Mm-hmm. But it isn't that simple. It turns out that it's not simply wealth. It's socioeconomic status is a much more complex construct than the amount of money you have. For example, if we ask what correlates better, your absolute wealth or your relative wealth, it turns out that the relative wealth correlates better in your community. So that if you're in a community where the gap between the poorer quintile and the wealthier quintile is greater, the poorer quintile dies sooner. So it's relative wealth. That's true from country to country. The poorer folks in Greece are poorer than the poorer folks in North Carolina, but the poorer folks in North Carolina die sooner.
Because of what we have referred to as the income gap?
It associates with the income mm-hmm. gap. We're going to have to talk more and more about do we understand why there is such a powerful association. But it's quite powerful. It goes state by state. It's been called the Robin Hood effect. The bigger the income gap in any one of our states, the sooner the poor die. And the smaller the income gap, which is the northern Midwest, which is similar to the Canadian provinces, the longer the poor live.
Now, do those at the other end of the spectrum in those areas, do they live longer too? Those who are in a higher class, then?
The data is...
Or is it averaging out here?
No, it doesn't average out. And the reason is that although we're not certain this will hold up, it looks pretty good right now that we will not live forever. One of Hadler's laws is the death rate is one per person.
Yeah.
And not only will we not live forever, but it looks like there's something of a ceiling for our species around 85. So it's not a truly an averaging principle. If a population is advantaged in the sense of the income gap, then most of the population tends to live toward that octogenarian decade. And by the way, this correlates exceedingly poorly with healthcare expenditure. In fact, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about health that relates to the structure of the community in which we live, and something about disease that relates to healthcare expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
And neither constructs follow one from the other directly.
Mm-hmm. We are talking today about poverty and health, and you're welcome to join our conversation. The number is 1-877-962-9862. With us is Dr. Norton Hadler, a professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, and Chris Conover is a professor of public policy studies at the Center for Health Policy at Duke. Chris Conover, can you explain to us why, then, given all of what Dr. Hadler said, why is it that the poor seem to have a shorter lifespan than the average person in the U.S.?
Well, at least part of the reason is because of lifestyle differences. There's a very interesting study that looked at the mortality risks associated with being low income and took into account the rates of smoking or excess drinking and risky lifestyle behavior such as that. It turns out that the risk of dying early was, 3.2 times higher for the lowest income group compared to the highest income group. But when you took into account their smoking behavior and other risky lifestyle factors, that differential dropped to 2.8. Okay, so lifestyle explains part of it, but it certainly doesn't explain all of it. I think Dr. Hadler made another very interesting and critical point, which is the differentials we see in mortality that relate to socioeconomic status are not unique to the U.S. So even in countries where we have universal coverage, you nevertheless still observe this mortality gradient, if you will, higher risks of dying early among those in the lowest income groups.
Mm.
Which is to say, the simple answer to the question is not to say, well, universal coverage is going to solve this. On the other hand, universal coverage certainly would shrink some of those differentials.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get to the conversation about universal coverage and whether that's a solution here mm-hmm. in the U.S. and whether there's more political traction for it now than there might have been a dozen years ago. But that's coming up. But what I still want to talk about why, if either of you can give me tangible reasons why. I mean, Chris Conover has just said that even when you take out whether people might be obese or smoke, there still is this lesser expectancy that they will live as long as the average person. The poor will not live as long as the average person. Tangibly, what is it? Something in their environment, in the homes that they're living in, that contributes?
Let me try to speak to that. We are not certain of the answer, but there are a number of associations that seem informative. Let me reiterate what Chris just said. About 80% of your mortal hazard does not relate to health adverse behaviors. About 80% of your mortal hazard is tucked into this construct, socioeconomic status, which we've already established is not simply money. It's something about community. And it's very powerful in a number of fashions. For example, there are cohort studies, communities that have been studied for decades and decades from this regard, where people have moved up in socioeconomic status as they got older. It turns out that they never quite attain the longevity likelihoods of people who were born into the strata into which they rose. So there's something very early on that determines this. There's a man, a Professor Barker in England, who actually has associations that drive back toward pregnancy and time in utero, as if there might be micronutrients. The other two associations that are worth talking about relate to this construct that floats around now called flow, which is an attempt to grasp the idea that you feel pretty comfortable in your skin more often than not. And the way we know about this is if you take population studies, cohort studies, followed for decades of employed people, such as the bureaucrats employed by the federal government in the United Kingdom, it was shown long time ago by Michael Marmot and his group that the higher the civil service rank, the longer you lived. And it was also shown that health adverse behaviors accounted for only a very minor component of that relationship, and what accounts for a goodly percentage of it is the simple question, do you like your job? So something about job satisfaction, something about the quality of the community as you perceive it, in which you live, something about your experience in utero, all of this feeds into the likelihood that your lower socioeconomic status will shorten your time on this planet.
We're talking today about poverty and health, health among the poor, and we'll be getting to the healthcare system here in North Carolina in just a moment. We're taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. With us, Dr. Norton Hadler, professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, and Chris Conover, a professor of public policy studies at Duke University. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencova. We're talking today about poverty and health care and health care policy. Our guests are Dr. Norton Hadler, professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, and Chris Conover, a professor of public policy studies at Duke University. And we're taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. Well, Chris Conover, I want to talk about stress, because that came to mind a moment ago when Dr. Hadler was speaking, saying that those who had perhaps worked themselves up the scale, socioeconomic scale, and could be considered content, they tended to live longer. And as he was saying that, I was wondering if you might get stressed by trying to get out of your at a lower socioeconomic level, trying to get out of poverty. But would that contribute to some health issues you might have, that striving to get out or striving and not being able to get out?
Well, I'm sure it does, and I couldn't put a number on that. What I can talk about, though, is some of the factors that relate to access to the health system and how those affect health status. If you look at the uninsured population as an example, the risk of being uninsured is much higher among poor people than for non-poor people. And the risk of death associated with being uninsured is 25% higher compared to those with private insurance. So it's a pretty important differential, but certainly not as big as the risk of being poor versus non-poor. Mm-hmm. But when we look at the reasons that the uninsured have a higher death risk, they relate to things such as delays in seeking care. They can't afford going to the doctor, and therefore they put off seeking care until by the time they enter the system. They may enter through the emergency room, and at that point, their health situation may have progressed to a point where, you know, now they're in a life and death situation, whereas if they had gotten some primary and preventive care earlier, they could have avoided being in that situation. Likewise, we've seen that for the uninsured, the quality of the care that they get once they're in the system appears to be different, you know, a little bit lower. And so some of the differential would be attributed to that. Mm-hmm. There's geographic access factors that relate to lack of coverage or lack of income. A lot of the poor, although not all of them, are covered by the Medicaid program. But there are a lot of providers who won't take Medicaid patients because the payment rates are too low. And as a consequence, individuals, even though they have a card that says, you know, technically they have insurance, they find it very difficult to find a provider to get the care that they need.
Because a provider would rather have a patient who's, like, say, on a private insurance plan that would compensate the provider, the doctor.
Right. It's a combination of they wouldn't get paid very well, or it's just too much red tape to file the claim compared to doing it with private insurance.
Do you have examples of what kind of different care someone might get, or I guess might not get, because they're poor?
Well, when they've looked at heart treatment as an example, the uninsured won't get the same level of, you know, diagnostic tests or procedures and things like that. And keep in mind, a lot of this really depends on where you go. If you come to a Duke University hospital, for example, you know, they take all comers, and the standard of care is really pretty uniform across the patient population. In a small community hospital, there may be situations where they really pay more attention to the payment status of the patients coming in, and they're not going to be as aggressive about ordering up diagnostic tests or procedures for, you know, a non-paying patient compared to a privately insured patient. So all of those factors play into this.
Dr. Hadler, there are a number of treatable diseases that hit in the communities where people are poor. But I should stress they are treatable, you know, heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, and yet the rates of that are so much higher. Are those things that could have almost been prevented in the first place?
I sort of set up this question with my initial comments because I have a very different take on the data based on my initial propositions that we have to think about assuring health and insuring against disease. We've already established that if we're talking about assuring health, then we need to look at the quality of life in the community, job security, and issues like that. If we're talking next about the minority of the mortal hazard in our world, which is disease that takes us away before our time, then the issue is effectiveness. And I have a much more critical look at the level of effectiveness than most of the lay press has understood. For example, interventional cardiology that Chris was just using as an example is extraordinarily short on evidence for effectiveness, either symptom control or longevity.
Meaning what?
Meaning it doesn't work. Cholesterol screening, we can screen for cholesterol, but the ability to treat people who are well, who have not had heart disease, and affect something that relates to their mortal hazard is trivial. So when we look at whether or not the access to the healthcare system is actually insuring you against disease, our first question is what we do effective? Our second question is, if we look at what we do that is effective, is there access? And for many of the issues that we have effective treatment, such as discussing the hazard, lifestyle hazards of in parents that relate to the health of the children, such as the treatment of acute infectious illnesses early, there are access issues that relate to socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. For things where the treatments and interventions are minimally effective, if at all, there actually are less access issues.
So it's a case of because you're poor, you have less access to these things, and therefore the rates, you're not getting cured as much as those who would have more money.
For the things that we have data as to effectiveness, mm-hmm. the lower your socioeconomic status, the less likely you will have access. Mm-hmm. For the things that we have no data that there's dramatic effectiveness, most of which are high-ticket items, there is less issue with access.
Okay. Let's go to Don in Durham. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hi. Did you have a question for our guests?
Yes. I was just wondering. I've noticed several of the insurers, and those with the worst reputations tend to have the highest profits of late. And I was just wondering, how much money do you think is actually coming out of the system? going into insurer shareholders and that sort of area, okay, compared to 10 years ago.
Should I go first,
sure,
Chris,
Dr. Hadler, or Dr. Hadler, and then Chris Conover?
You can start.
We know from studies from Wool Handler and her colleagues that we have an enormous overhead in the so-called healthcare delivery system, well over 50%, and that if you take a look at where the remainder of the monies go, what you learn is that about half of them go to things for which we have no data as to effectiveness, and another significant percentage go to the way we approach the last days of life. And a very small percentage of this enormous thing that's euphemistically called the healthcare dollar actually is involved in insuring you against disease.
Mm-hmm. Chris Conover?
In terms of profitability, I think that profits are slightly higher now than they were, say, 10 years ago. In terms of the dollar amounts and what fraction of the entire healthcare system they represent, profits per se are relatively small. So I guess one question I wanted to ask Dr. Hadler was, did I understand you to say that half of what we spend on healthcare is in that last year of life?
No.
Dr. Hadler, no.
What I said was over half was in the overhead of running our particular system. That's the 50% number.
And now, when you say overhead, do you mean that's all administrative paperwork, or is that just running the system so we have the hospitals and what actually people would say, they need that physical facility, they need that building to go into, they need the operating room and the rest. Is that the overhead?
No, the overhead actually is administrative costs, administrative personnel, paper pushing, all of the. We know that because you just have to look at every other resource-advantaged country and ask what the per capita cost of their healthcare delivery system is, particularly those that do have national health schemes, and you discover that we're multiples of that. The Japanese, for example, are well under $1,000 per capita per year, and their health statistics in terms of longevity have been leading the world. So there's something about our system that is, to be kind, at the very least, highly inefficient. To be less kind, highly abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And
Chris Conover?
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that if you look at the reason U.S. spending is way above other countries, the difference in our per capita income is a very large factor. That is, we demand more services because we have higher incomes. And I don't want to argue that the administrative costs are lower here than they are elsewhere. They probably are higher. But I'm not sure that they account for the full difference between our spending and Canada's, just as an example.
No, I agree with that. However, we demand more services without having more effectiveness in terms of our healthcare statistics. Furthermore, we demand services that are without substantial scientific basis for effectiveness.
Right.
So maybe we're being sold a bill of goods.
There's a huge amount of excess in our system, no doubt about it. And the other contributing factor to the differentials we see in the U.S. versus other countries is that we pay our providers much more. So a doctor in this country earns a lot more than a physician in Canada or Britain.
We're talking about poverty and health care this hour. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 1-877-962-9862. And we have segued into this conversation now about which health system would best serve all of us, serve the poor. But I guess those might be two different conversations. And I'm curious, Dr. Hadler, would you advocate a universal system?
Of course. I mean, absolutely. Not only that, if it is effective in resource-advantaged countries, it ought to be made available regardless of your socioeconomic status. The crucial issue is that if it is ineffective, then neither the rich nor the poor should have to either be subjected to such medicine or pay for it. Mm-hmm. And there are major differentials on that statement that are transnational, and a considerable amount of information that would inform healthcare reform in this country if it wasn't for the fact that we seem entrenched in the notion that the more expensive and the more high-tech, by definition, the more effective, and that notion turns out to be testable and more often than not disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chris Conover, where do you stand on universal care? You see problems that we have with the system now. Should the U.S. jump into a universal care system? Or make its way to a universal care system?
I think that the U.S. would be better off with a universal care system, but the notion I would have is really quite different than the one that Dr. Hadler has. I think that medical insurance should be insurance. That is, it should protect us against unexpected losses. And to the extent that we try to use insurance to pay for routine things, you know, think of if our auto insurance were used to pay for oil changes and putting gas in our car. What we'd discover is that the cost of oil changes and putting gas in our car would be a lot more because someone else is paying for that. And the same is true in healthcare. So there's a lot of nickel and dime things that we pay for in healthcare that cost more because we're running claims through an insurance company, you know, and therefore there's an overhead cost associated with paying for that care. Plus the prices of those services are that much higher because people who are using someone else's dollars to pay for them don't really care to shop for the best bargains. So I would like to see a universal coverage system where we have universal catastrophic coverage to pay for the back end care that people cannot afford, but that we mostly are on our own in terms of paying for upfront care that we can afford. And we would discover in the process that we'd have a much more affordable system.
I wonder, though, if people might put off going to the doctor when something starts to go wrong because they're having to pay out of pocket. Because for a generation or two or three now, we've been raised where, you know, a lot of us do have health insurance and are accustomed to having, you know, a minimal copay when they go to the doctor. So we would go to the doctor as soon as we felt ill rather than letting it fester, shall we say, until we get to the point where it's catastrophic. Or does there just have to be a re-education in play here?
No, that's a great point. And the answer to that question, I mean, that's been answered. It was answered by a RAND health insurance study done 20 years ago. And they actually did a scientific controlled trial where they randomly assigned people into different kinds of insurance plans, including one that was basically a catastrophic coverage plan of the sort I just described. You had a very high deductible, and then after that, the plan would take over paying for your care. It turned out then when you looked at health status and life expectancy and various sorts of measures, the people in the catastrophic plan were not in worse health, in the general population, were not in worse health compared to those who had completely free care. It is true, however, that those who had low incomes were worse off in a catastrophic style plan compared to individuals who were getting free care. And there was an elevated risk of death and that sort of thing, which is to say that if we're to reconfigure the system, you know, a catastrophic plan seems to be fine for most people, but we would have to design something special for those with the lowest incomes, and we would have to protect them against the temptation to defer and delay needed care.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hadler, does this happen in effect right now? Because the poor who may not qualify for Medicaid and may not have a private insurance plan do, in fact, put off getting care. And we know the phenomenon of going to the emergency room for the first time that they would see a doctor about their particular condition because ERs, by federal law, have to take you regardless of your ability to pay.
No doubt. Plus, I have a different philosophy, and a lot of what we're talking about has to do with philosophy of health and philosophy of disease avoidance. Copays are a problem for me. If things work and we're sharing the risk for each other's disease insurance, which is what insurance is for, then it ought to be available. However, if things don't work, then I don't want to share the risk with you of having something that doesn't work. So actually, we've been modeling a very different disease insurance plan, taking advantage of the 20 years now of systematic studies of the effectiveness of a lot of things that go on in modern medicine, particularly the newer things and certainly the more expensive things. And what you learn is that you can model a universal health disease insurance plan based on the discussion of how much effectiveness is worthwhile to you. For example, if I can do something to you and tell you that I have to treat 50 people with this intervention to save one life, then I would argue that, number one, we probably can't measure that level of effectiveness, and it's not worthwhile. We won't pay for it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I can treat 20 people and save one life, I would argue that we ought to pay for it entirely. And between 1 in 20 and 1 in 50 is a lot of philosophical argument, but that ought to be the argument, and it would change the entire complexion of the disease insurance scheme in this country.
And we'll get back to more of our conversation about insurance and poverty and the wellness of the poor in our series, North Carolina Voices, Understanding Poverty. More of our conversation with Dr. Norton Hadler and Chris Conover just ahead, and more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. We're talking this hour, as we have been last week and this, about poverty. Today we're talking about poverty, healthcare, and healthcare policy. With us are Dr. Norton Hadler, professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, and Chris Conover, a professor of public policy studies in the health area at Duke University. The number is 1-877-962-9862, and Maureen is on the line from Hillsborough. Hi, Maureen.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the program. Did you have a question for our guest?
I have a question and a comment. Mm-hmm. I'm driving, so bear with me.
Okay, be careful.
I will. Actually, I'm going kind of slow right now around the corner. My question is, has anybody done any, looked at the statistics for people who lived in poverty, let's say 50 or 100 years ago, compared to the wealthy in during that time period as opposed to this time period? And I'll tell you why I'm asking that question. I grew up in a family of 12. My father had a sixth grade education. We definitely lived in poverty. I am no longer living in poverty, but I have siblings who live in poverty, and they all have health issues. They're under an enormous amount of stress. They can't afford, for example, simple things like purified water treatment system in their home. High sugar diets produced a lot of them having a lot of cavities in their mouth, which I believe the mercury amalgam over time leaches into your body and produces all kinds of problems. The stress, the enormous amount of stress of being in poverty and living in the city surrounded by people who, you know, don't take care of their properties, and just the enormous amount of stress that they all feel. And I think that living in poverty just creates all sorts of environmental and psychological and physiological problems. They can't afford to take vacations to... Mm-hmm. Hello?
Yes, we're here. We're here.
Okay.
Well, I'm curious, Maureen, what if knowing that situation as you do, very personally, is there something you would recommend that...
Well, you know, I'm a Christian, and I don't think that we're going to solve this problem. I just see there's a bigger and bigger gap between the rich and the poor, and the health issues that the poor suffer, and they just can't afford what they need to get them up, to pull them up by their bootstrings so that they can live a comfortable, non-stressful life. And it's just getting more and more difficult for poor people to do that. They don't have the education, they don't have the resources, they don't have the mm-hmm. environment, they don't have the psychological support.
Right, and I'm curious, we're talking today in particular about those in poverty and health. Would having a reliable healthcare system, healthcare that they could access, would that go a ways?
Okay, let's go back a step. It's all about prevention, okay? Once you've got, for example, my dad died of cancer last year. He was a World War II veteran. He was not given the same tests, just preventatively to see what might be going on, and the same diet that my husband's father, who lives, he's a very wealthy man, he's got better health care, he eats a better diet, he's more educated, he takes vacations, he doesn't have as much stress in his life. Yes, the health care is definitely important, but it's prevention.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And living the kind of lifestyle and having access to the same things that health, that wealthy people have access to, and we're not going to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to put your comments to Chris Conover, who has studied this kind of policy. Chris Conover?
Well, I don't know the answer to the question of whether the poor today are worse off compared to the poor of 50 years ago. I do know that in sort of raw material terms, the poor of today are better off than many, sort of the average family in 1950. And likewise, if you compare the poor in the U.S. to the poor in other countries, in material terms, they're sort of better off. But that goes back to Dr. Hadler's point that it's really about relative deprivation and that sort of thing. I think that's all I have to say. Maybe Dr. Hadler wants to put in some comments as well.
Yeah, the caller had a number of points. The issue of stratification, the way we structure our society, as we've been saying all along, accounts for a tremendous percentage, the vast majority, of your health, your mortal hazard, in very dramatic ways. For example, the longevity in Russia went down 10 years within 10 years of tearing down the Berlin Wall. It's not because there's been an epidemic of health adverse behaviors. In fact, there were a fair amount of health adverse behaviors when the wall was up. This has to do with the structure of society. There are some horrifying experiments of our modern society that we all need to know about. For example, one of the biggest health risks that we've come across epidemiologically turns out to be downsizing and outsourcing. Downsizing and outsourcing is a euphemism for half of your coworkers will be unemployed, the other half will have no benefits and a lower salary. You can follow coping skills, you can follow health adverse behaviors, and you can follow longevity through these so-called experiments and learn that people put through this kind of an experience do very poorly. So I agree with the caller. I think actually in terms of relative poverty, the stratification of society, the income gap, we seem to be moving back toward the turn of the prior century rather than advancing where we were advancing through the 60s and 70s, even though we were far from advanced.
1-877-962-9862 is the number. You know, one issue that dogs a lot of communities, especially in rural areas, is having enough health care, period, doctors to work in rural areas. And that's also an issue, I think, in some urban centers, too. There has been a limit put, an artificial limit put on the number of doctors trained over the past few decades. There had been concern about having a glut of doctors. And now I understand there are efforts to train more doctors. Chris Conover, would training more doctors and having more of them out there, is that one way to, perhaps even get it bringing down costs because you'd have a greater supply of people who could do that job? And B, just getting access to people in poorer communities.
Well, I'll be honest. I think that if we're going to train more professionals, I would encourage us to be training mid-levels such as nurse practitioners or physician assistants. That would be a more cost-effective way of expanding the number of individuals who could do the primary and preventive care that seems to be lacking.
Because
right
it's
now.
Fewer years of training?
Well, right. I mean, there have been studies after studies show that they basically provide the equivalent or better quality care at a much lower cost. Now, they can't do all of the things that physicians can do. You need, physicians backing them up. But the point is, in terms of expanding the numbers of individuals out there, that would be a more cost-effective strategy for dealing with it.
Dr. Hadler?
Yeah, there are many levels to your question. Is there a doctor shortage? A lot of us are not so certain. There certainly is maldistribution, not only geographic maldistribution, but maldistribution in the way physicians are rewarded to spend their time. So it's hard for me to imagine this country needs more cardiologists, but we sure are putting out a fair number of cardiologists. And I would...
But there is, we should say, though, compared to another profession, law, which sometimes you have lawyers and doctors at odds, there had been, the federal government pays for just so many doctors to go into residency out of the Medicaid program. So there had been that limit put by Congress on how many doctors are going to get the training, the hands-on training, after they get out of med school, whereas there's not an equal limit, say, in another profession, in law. You know, some might argue we have too many lawyers because there's not that limit.
But the federal government isn't subsidizing lawyers either for their training.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question is, you know, how many doctors do you need, and how many doctors is it appropriate for the federal government to subsidize?
Right, right.
And I agree with Dr. Hadler. It's not clear whether there's a shortage or not. I certainly agree with this idea that there's a sort of a maldistribution of the providers who are out there in terms of what they're doing and where they are.
How could we better get doctors to where they're needed then?
Well, that's been a challenge. I think that North Carolina has done better than many states in terms of what they've done in terms of rural health and encouraging doctors to get out to rural areas by building, you know, community-based clinics and things like that. But, you know, we have by no means totally solved the problem either. The difficulty is in rural areas, you know, people in rural areas are more likely to be uninsured, and therefore you have, and they're more likely to be poor, and therefore you have fewer resources in a rural community to support a physician practice. And as well, a physician or many physicians like, you know, being close to cities and having some of the advantages of being near cities in terms of cultural aspects and things like that. So it is a challenge how to solve this problem. It's not an easy problem to solve.
Okay. Dr. Hadler, before we go.
Yeah, I agree. We have a perverse reimbursement system. I'm a rheumatologist, and I have come to realize over the past decades that if my trainees practiced the way I trained them, they'd probably starve to death. We're called cognitive physicians, which means that what we do most of is listen to patients and try to provide wise counsel when choices are not clear. There's almost no reimbursement for that. There is a lot of reimbursement for sticking needles into you. And one needs to wonder why this country has taken that tack and whether or not it's reversible.
Mm-hmm. And that's a conversation we'll have to continue another day. I'd like to thank you both for joining us today. Dr. Norton Hadler is professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill and author of the book The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. And Chris Conover is a professor of public policy at the Center for Healthcare Policy at Duke University. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last week, we aired a commentary by Isabel Geffner, executive director of the Community Backyard. In it, Isabel Geffner expressed concern over a proposal that would change the way mental health services are provided and delivered to children and families in North Carolina. Today, Lisa Wainwright, deputy director of the North Carolina Department of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, and Substance Abuse Services, offers a different view.
First, I firmly believe we're on the right track with mental health reform. I also fully agree with anyone who says that children's services should be coordinated and any fragmented services eliminated. In fact, this is exactly what the new proposed service definitions will do. Under the new definitions and the state's reform plan, every mentally ill or emotionally disturbed child served through the public mental health, developmental disabilities, and substance abuse service system will choose, with the help of their family, a comprehensive service-providing agency in their community to serve as the child's clinical home. This clinical home will be charged with and held accountable for developing and implementing a person-centered plan for the child that includes input from all other agencies and providers that may be interacting with the child and their family. This change alone will reduce fragmentation and duplication of services and will eliminate the multiple providers who often don't communicate to one another problem many parents and guardians have complained about in the past. More important, the clinical home stays with the child no matter if they have to move to a different area for a specific medical services or treatment. The child remains the daily responsibility of the clinical home, and the home must maintain contact with the child and their family to coordinate care as well as facilitate and expedite the child's return to the home community or transition to a less intensive service. One new service that will be provided under the proposed definitions is called community support. The community support service definition requires the same high quality of training for staff as is required for the current case management service. By changing the definition of community support, we are clarifying and emphasizing that the duties and responsibilities historically performed by a mental health case manager must be performed by a clinician who meets the standards and rules to be a qualified mental health professional. We reject any implication that this change reflects any supposed lowering of professional standards. In fact, we are raising the standards. The new definitions mandate that fully licensed clinicians lead intensive in-home teams. We also will now require all children served receive a complete diagnostic assessment performed by two skilled professionals, one of whom must be a doctor, a licensed psychologist, a physician's assistant, or a family nurse practitioner. There has also been concern that we will be reducing the amount of services that children receive through the new definitions. That is not true. The problem in the current system is that we have very few tools in our toolkit. If 1 hour of a service wasn't working well for the child and family, we tried 2 hours. And if that didn't work, we've gone to 4 hours, and on and on. Or, in the absence of effective services in the community, we have placed far too many of North Carolina's children into group homes, away from their home communities and their families. These new services, coupled with person-centered planning, will increase the flexibility of local programs to provide new and more individualized mental health services in ways that are not possible under the current system. We proudly agree that we are basing our new services on a recovery model, since that is what repeated clinical studies have consistently documented to be the most effective treatment possible. Recovery is defined as assisting persons with disabilities to live as independently as possible in communities of their choice. We believe that is the outcome that all families want for their children, whether or not they have a mental illness.
Lisa Wainwright is Deputy Director of the North Carolina Department of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, and Substance Abuse Services. And for today, that's the state of things. Support for our series, North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty, comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, Doug and Peggy Abrams, the Julian Price Family Foundation, Maupin Taylor, PA, the Michael and Laura Brader Arahe Foundation, and the North Carolina Humanities Council. Now, if you have a comment about our series, North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty, we would love to hear from you. The hotline number is 1-877-3-VOICES. That's 1-877-3-VOICES. And as always, if you have a comment about the state of things, you can send us an email here as well. That email address is sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Melinda Pencava.